This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: bodies of more than 8,000 Palestinians are missing in Gaza, as the death toll from the Israeli onslaught surpasses 20,000. The Israeli military admits that nearly 500 of its troops have been killed in Gaza, as Palestinian resistance fighters say that they have destroyed 35 Israeli military vehicles in recent days. Also in the headlines, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman categorically rejects U.S. allegations that Iran was behind the recent drone attack on an oil tanker in the Indian Ocean. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. Thanks for joining us. It has been 80 days since Israel launched its deadly onslaught on Gaza. The regime has carried out fresh strikes that dovetail with the narrative that the onslaught is actually a genocidal war. At least 95 people have been killed in the strike in the Al-Maghazi camp in central Gaza. The air raid also injured dozens of others. Gaza's government office has once again urged the international community to put pressure on Israel to stop its genocide. The resistance movement Hamas also described the bombardment as a horrific massacre. Other areas across Gaza also witnessed new strikes. In Deir al-Balah, 7 people lost their lives after warplanes bombed a residential building. Another airstrike killed around 24 Palestinians in the southern city of Khan Yunis. To the north, the regime's bombardment killed 10 members of a family in the Jabalia camp. The total death toll is now over 20,400, most of them women and children. The military wing of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has released a statement on its recent retaliatory attacks against invading Israeli forces in Gaza. The Al-Qassam Brigade says its fighters have killed 48 Israeli troops during a number of operations over the past 4 days. It added that the operations involved missiles, anti-fortification, and anti-personnel devices. According to Al-Qassam, its fighters also clashed with the regime forces at point-blank range. In the same period, 35 Israeli military vehicles were partially or completely destroyed as well. Israel says 162 of its troops have been killed since the start of the ground invasion of Gaza in October. Palestinians say the actual number is much higher. The military wing of Hamas has pounded the Israeli military's headquarters and command centers, as well as some gatherings of the regime forces in the Gaza Strip. The group has also targeted Tel Aviv with missiles. The World Health Organization has warned that the health system in Gaza is being destroyed. WHO head Tedros Adhanom said the decimation of the Gaza health system is a tragedy. He reiterated his call for an immediate ceasefire. The UN Health Agency has long been sounding the alarm about the state of health care in the besieged territory. Of Gaza's original 36 hospitals, only 9 are now partially functional, all of them in the south, and all of them overwhelmed. After missions last week to 2 badly damaged hospitals in the north, WHO staff described unbearable scenes of largely abandoned patients, including young children begging for food and water. The Israeli regime continues to kill Palestinian journalists in Gaza on an almost daily basis. Israeli forces have killed scores of journalists since October the 7th of this year, in a grave violation of international laws and norms. Intentional targeting of journalists is considered a war crime and also a crime against humanity.
On October 7th, the Israeli regime launched brutal bombardment of the Gaza Strip, killing and maiming tens of thousands of innocent civilians. Palestinian journalists and media workers were no exception. The Israeli regime has so far killed more than 100 Palestinian journalists as well as dozens of their family members. According to Reporters Without Borders, Palestinian journalists have no safe refuge and no way of leaving the blockaded territory.
Every day, Zionist forces target journalists in Gaza, and if they cannot kill them, they kill their family members. The Zionist regime has killed scores of our colleagues along with their families. Tel Aviv wants to silence us and prevent us from exposing Israeli war crimes.
Over the course of the Israeli onslaught, dozens of Gazan journalists have also been reported missing, detained, or injured. Israeli forces have also targeted their media offices and homes.
My message to the international community is that we here as a journalist, we didn't feel that we are safe. We are targeted, and every time we can be bombed with the Israeli occupation forces. So my message is that we have to be saved. We are doing our work. We are only covering the acts that Israeli made here in the Gaza Strip. So we are trying to get this message to the world.
Experts have dubbed the Israeli aggression since October 7th as the deadliest period for journalists covering military conflicts in more than three decades.
We were displaced from the Tell al-Hawa neighborhood in Gaza City to the house of our friend, the journalist Adel Zorob, in Rafah. He hosted us for 70 days, and a few days ago, my family was sleeping in the room close to his room, and an Israeli airstrike killed him along with several members of his family and my family.
Reporters Without Borders has described the Gaza Strip as the graveyard of journalists.
Journalists in Gaza have been at the forefront of the campaign to expose Israeli crimes against innocent civilians. Experts say Palestinian journalists are paying the price for the international apathy toward Israeli war crimes. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Mariam Saleh is a correspondent joining us from Beirut to give us the latest ongoings regarding what is happening between the resistance forces, including Hezbollah, and the Israeli regime forces. Well, Mariam, we understand that there has been some developments today, one sad one. Tell us what has occurred.
Well, we know definitely that there is continuous Israeli shelling on the several towns, of course, the bordering towns especially. We had just recently a shelling of the town of Naqoura, also the towns of Hanin, and this is one of the towns that has not been subject to many of the shelling of the Israelis. We also have, in addition to Naqoura, we have Aitarun, we have Aitashab. Taibi, that is one of the towns that is getting a full share of Israeli shelling, despite the fact that it is not adjacent to the border. And so we definitely see the Israelis basically moving further off from the border, especially after there is an especially after a resistance operation. And most of the resistance operations are precise to the extent that usually Hezbollah is saying they are always targeting gatherings of soldiers. And if they are not inflicting losses and causing wounds, wounded soldiers, they are definitely killing many of those soldiers in the northern Galilee, in the northern occupied Palestine. We also can see the difference when it comes to the more settlements that are being closed down or being evacuated by the Israelis, whether it is from a demand of their government or the Zionist regime, of course, or whether it is from their own expense. There are many of the settlers that have said that they cannot remain in that area because they do not feel protected, they do not feel safe, despite the fact that they do have bunkers and they do have shelters. Even throughout the past wars, let's say if we could just draw a comparison, for example, when Hezbollah just first began to use Katyusha rockets back in 1993, the Israelis just went down to their shelters or their bunkers that are underground. They were built originally by the Zionist regime, since they know that this regime was built on wars, and so they definitely had those shelters built as they built those settlements. During those wars, 1993, then in 1996 also as well, Hezbollah used Katyusha rockets again to reinstate an equilibrium or an equation that they had begun, which is that once the Israelis launch an aggression against civilians, once they target civilians, then Hezbollah will target settlements, which, of course, Hezbollah believes that they're even the settlements that are there or those so-called civilians are also people who served in the Israeli army. But in any case, if the Israelis call this a civilian settlement, it will be targeted by Hezbollah. But now you see that even their bunkers and even their shelters are not enough to keep them safe, and so they have left the entire area. Now we have an additional settlement that was also evacuated. We have more roads that are blocked by the Israeli army, not allowing anyone to return to that area because it is a closed military zone. And ironically, we hear from the Israeli officials every single day. We have statements on Lebanon. It is true that what is happening inside Gaza, inside Palestine, is very significant. It is taking a toll on the Israeli army, but we always hear statements coming out from the officials that they cannot bear what is happening inside in the Galilee area within the confrontation of Hezbollah. We also hear the Israeli ambassador in the United States making his calls in the United States as well, with Washington, with the White House, saying that they cannot bear what is happening in Lebanon, pushing the U.S. to put more efforts, as they are, of course, they're trying to use those cards here in Lebanon. That continues. That is the case. We had, of course, yesterday, three very significant operations. Despite the minimal operations, in some cases, Hezbollah seems to have a policy when they basically are going for qualitative operations. And it's not just a number of operations. In some cases, you have 12, 13 operations against the bases. There definitely needs to be a targeting of those bases on a daily basis. But you know also that the Israelis have also pushed back their forces. Further off from the border, they are not all remaining in the post. Despite that, Hezbollah has also targeted the newly situated posts, the ones that go beyond that border, some newly formed barracks and posts and bunkers as well for the Israeli forces, whether it is in infantry or the elite forces that are in that area have also been targeted by Hezbollah. Hezbollah has used the Burkan rocket on and on in several cases. Of course, the Katyusha rocket is only used after the targeting of civilians in Lebanon. We see definitely that this has been used several times. And so this is basically the case. This is what we're looking at right now. There is definitely a tit-for-tat continuous operations. But the Israelis are, like I said, moving a bit more, stepping up their firepower. They're also going further off. And we're talking about just on the border of the Litani River. And if they do cross that, I believe Hezbollah will probably have more to say if they cross the northern parts of the Litani, if they go further off from 20 kilometers. And we were talking about the Khardale River, which is part of the Litani River. There was a main road that was targeted. Two people were almost killed, in addition to also the cameraman for Al-Manar television. That is something that we are looking at, of course, to see if Hezbollah will have a retaliation against that specifically. But of course, these operations will continue, and this comes in light of the fact that there are continuous pressure. There's a lot of pressure coming not only from the United States, but also from countries like France and Britain, who are trying to pull some strings, basically, here in Lebanon.
Thank you so much for that, Mariam Saleh. We appreciate it. And, of course, one of the Mariam Saleh from Beirut. Many thanks. Moving on, the freed Palestinian prisoners are recounting their harrowing stories of torture while in the Israeli military's custody. Released detainees say that they were kept tied up for days. They were beaten up, and also they were not allowed to eat or drink or use the toilet. Some say Israeli soldiers poured cold water on them throughout the night. The hospital director in the city of Rafah, in the south of the Gaza Strip, says around 20 men released from Israeli detention and admitted to the hospital had bruises and marks of beatings on their bodies. Tehran categorically rejects U.S. allegations that Iran was behind the recent drone attack on an oil tanker in the Indian Ocean. The foreign ministry spokesman says the accusations are baseless. Nasser Kanani says Tehran has always played a significant role in ensuring the security of navigation and trade in international waters. Kanani made the remarks in his weekly presser. He said the U.S. is to blame for the recent tensions in regional waters. According to the spokesman, this is because the U.S. is the sole culprit for the Israeli war on the Gaza Strip, its continuation, and the regime's war crimes against Palestinians. The spokesman also slammed, in his words, endless U.S. allegations against Tehran. He noted that Iran has always acted responsibly in international waters, and the U.S. is not in a position to make accusations across the country. Back to the events unfolding in the Gaza Strip in the genocidal U.S.-Israeli war. Muti Abu Musaba is our correspondent joining us from Deir al-Balah. Muti, over to you.
Yes, as you know that the Israeli occupation forces maintain their airstrikes and incursions on Gaza Strip, the people here are still shocked with the latest massacre, the appalling massacre actually that took place in the middle area of Gaza Strip, particularly Al-Maghazi city. We are talking about increasing number as the civil defense crews here in the middle area are attempting to extract more dead bodies from under the rubble of those destroyed houses, taking the number of the Palestinian civilians who have been slaughtered to over than 70 Palestinian civilians, in addition to dozens of the Palestinian civilians, Muslim women and children, are still trapped and missing under the rubble of those destroyed houses. According to the Gaza Health Ministry and the civil defense crews, that the number of the Palestinian civilians who are still missing and trapped under the rubble actually exceeded 8,000 Palestinian civilians. And when we are talking about this number, we are talking about another dark side of this continuous and ongoing onslaught waged against the Palestinian people. And according to the eyewitnesses and the testimonies of the crews of the civil defense here in Gaza Strip, that the number actually exceeds exceeds 8,000, because there are many families, really are hundreds of the Palestinian families who were completely targeted and killed by the Israeli airstrikes, and there are a lot of people and hundreds of the people who haven't been reported. So it's estimated that the number exceeds 8,000, because the Israeli airstrikes are continued. And there is something important to consider in this regard, that those buildings which are targeted by the Israeli airstrikes, they are totally and completely overwhelmed and crowded with the people, because these buildings actually include the people, the families who are the owners of this house. In addition to that, they have the Palestinian displaced people who were enforced to evacuate from the northern parts and Gaza City to the middle area over the very beginning of this onslaught. So this actually what increases the number of the Palestinian civilians, particularly those who are still trapped under the rubble. And another aspect in this regard is about the lack of the needed tools and equipment used by the civil defense to help them to extract and to pull out the dead bodies from the rubble or from under the rubble, because as you know that these crews and this civil defense system for more than 17 years in a row, they are suffering from the lack of those needed equipment, because there are many incidents took place here in Gaza Strip even before this aggression, and they were appealing for everyone else, for the entire world to help and to assist the civil defense crews with the needed equipment and instruments and tools to help handling any kind of any incident or any kind of any aggression.
Thank you very much, Muti Abu Musabi, our correspondent from Darabala. Thank you for your updates there. With that, we come to an end with this edition of World News. Thanks so much for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Jesus, peace upon him, one of the five greatest prophets of God. In the name of God, Salam, dear friends, and greetings to our Christian listeners on the occasion of Christmas, which this year is without its usual festivities due to the genocide in the Gaza of the Palestinian people by the enemies of Jesus, the despicable Zionists. Dear listeners, please stay with us for a special feature on this occasion. Today, the 25th of December, is celebrated by most Christian sects as the birthday of the Virgin-born Jesus. The various versions of the Gospels in circulation amongst the Christians, whether these books are regarded canonical or non-canonical, depending upon the church the Christians follow, do not mention this date or, for that matter, any other date. Moreover, Jesus was born in a monotheistic family that adhered to the laws of God Almighty and had not deviated from the teachings of Moses and other prophets, like most of the rebellious Israelites who used to conspire with their polytheist Romans overlords. His family followed the lunar calendar and not the solar calendar of the Romans. Thus, as acknowledged by the biblical scholars, December 25th was actually the day of bacchanal festivities in the pagan Roman Empire, and when Europe became Christian, several centuries after the birth and departure of Jesus without the Gentiles, non-Jews, having any information about him, the day was fixed as the birthday of Messiah. So, when was Son of Mary born? Let us first wish our Christian friends a happy Christmas and utilize this opportunity to search Islamic texts for the answer. It is worth noting that Islam regards Jesus as one of the five greatest prophets of God, the other four being Noah, Abraham, Moses, and the last and greatest of them all, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. According to the Noble Quran, which we Muslims believe as God's final revelation to mankind and free from any interpolation, as was the fate of the previously revealed heavenly scriptures, like the Torah and the Evangel, Jesus neither claimed to be the Son of God nor was he crucified. Once, when a learned Christian came to Hejaz in quest of his investigations on Abrahamic religions, he was introduced to Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, the seventh infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. To his surprise, he found the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt more knowledgeable of the Judeo-Christian texts than he himself. After explaining the dynamics of Islam, the seventh Imam said, "I will inform you of something that only a few people know who have read the books. Tell me the day on which Mary conceived and the hour of the day, and the day and the hour on which Mary gave birth to Jesus." The Christian scholar was confused and confessed, "I do not know." Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, said, "The day on which Mary conceived, it was Friday at noon, and that was the day the Ruhul Amin, the trustworthy spirit, came down to her from God with tidings of a boy to be born to her. And there is no festival better than this for Muslims. Allah Almighty magnified it, and Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, magnified it and ordered that Friday should be a holiday." The Imam continued, Do you know beside which river Mary gave birth to Jesus? The Christian scholar said, no. Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, said, it was the Euphrates, and beside it were date palms and grapevines. It is interesting to note that in Beit Lahm, there are no date palms, and moreover, Mary had withdrawn to a secluded and far-off place as the time of the delivery approached in order to be safe from the slanders of the Jews. That is the reason when she returned to her hometown with Jesus. Almighty Allah empowered the infant in the cradle to remove any doubt about the virginity of his mother by saying, as is evident by Ayah 30 of Surah Maryam, Jesus said, indeed, I am a servant of Allah. He has given me the book and made me a prophet. As for the date and the lunar month in which Jesus was born, a famous narration from the Prophet's 8th infallible heir, Imam Reza, peace upon him, completes the dialogue which his father, Imam Musa Kazem, peace upon him, had with the Christian scholar. The Muslim scholar, Hassan ibn Ali al-Washa, has informed us, I was with my father and I was a youth, and we spent the night with Imam Reza, peace upon him. It was the night of the 25th of Dhul-Qa'dah, and he said to my father, on the night of the 25th of Dhul-Qa'dah, Abraham was born, and on it Jesus, the son of Mary, was born. And on it, the dry earth beneath the Kaaba appeared for the first time and was made to spread. Whoever fasts of that day, it is as if he were to fast for 60 months. It is also worth noting that Arabs and Israelites follow the same lunar calendar with slight differences. Could it mean that the 25th of the lunar month was transformed in the 25th of December as the birthday of Jesus when the Roman Empire became Christian? And God gave Jesus astounding miracles, as he had granted to the other prophets. God granted him permission to heal the blind and those who suffered from other diseases. One of the most amazing miracles of Jesus was the revival of the dead. He raised to life many people on divine command. He even informed them of the foods people ate or stored at home. Despite all these miracles, there were few who believed in Jesus. The leaders of the Israelites, who saw their position at risk, feared his mission and plotted against him. They viewed the Messiah as an obstacle to their desires, so they sought to kill him. But God lifted Jesus to the heavens and saved him from the Israelites and the pagan Romans, who crucified one of the seditious persons they mistook for the Messiah. Christians and some other people believe that the enemies of Jesus crucified him and killed him on Friday. But after 3 days of death, on Saturday, he was revived and went to heaven. But the Noble Quran rejects the death and crucifixion of the Messiah and says in Ayah 157 of Surah Nisa, and for their saying, we killed the Messiah, Jesus, son of Mary, the prophet of Allah, though they did not kill him, nor did they crucify him. But so it was made to appear to them. Indeed, Those who differ concerning him are surely in doubt about him. They do not have any knowledge of that beyond falling conjectures, and certainly they did not kill him. Yes, God saved Jesus from his enemies and lifted him to the heaven. Jesus will return to the earth in the end times to serve as lieutenant to Imam Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance. The 12th and last infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, for establishment of the global government of peace, prosperity and justice. We again wish our Christian listeners a Merry Christmas and invite them to ponder on these facts, with emphasis on the need to rid our region and the world of the evil presence of the Zionists, the sworn enemies of Jesus. Goodbye, and God bless you.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, the Israeli apartheid regime continues to commit genocide in Gaza. During the last 24 hours alone, at least 166 Palestinians have been killed by the regime. However, as the entity continues to commit gruesome crimes in Gaza, the Palestinian resistance has been fierce against the Zionists. Over the weekend, at least 15 Israeli soldiers were killed, and their prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, admits that Israel is paying a heavy price. Officially, 153 soldiers have been killed, but Hamas and eyewitnesses say the casualty rate is much higher as the regime tries to cover up the reality. Well, we're going to take a look at the latest out of Gaza on this Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Daniel Yevcic, author and researcher out of Barcelona. And John Phoenix, journalist and international relations expert out of London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with me. Let's start it off in Barcelona. Now, Danielle, the resistance has been effective against the Israeli military machine. I mean, how is this possible when there's really no comparison in the weapons, equipment, and, of course, support, technical support that the regime has, and yet we see that even the Israeli prime minister has to admit that it's actually much more difficult than they expected.
Yeah, and these developments show again the weakness of the Zionist entity, which despite all of the funding that it receives from its backers in the United States and the European Union, including this unlimited support and weapons, it is still unable to defeat the indigenous people. And I think this is also the core of this contradiction here. So despite this support and the alleged military supremacy that the Israeli entity has been having, it is unable to defeat Hamas or to defeat Palestinians, because Palestinians are fighting for their survival, standing on their land as indigenous people, while the Israeli army has, of course, for decades practiced apartheid and has trained by torturing children in the West Bank and sabotaging Palestinians' everyday lives. And so for the past 2.5 months or so, the Israeli regime has been bombarding Gaza, applying apparently its Dahiya doctrine, which includes the very heavy bombing of densely populated civilian areas. But again, the way that the Israeli regime is framing this genocide as an alleged war against Hamas is not a war that it could ever win. It is in its structure genocidal, and it's showing the limits of the settlers who came from other parts of the world to Palestine to kill the indigenous people. And the Israeli regime is very likely, if the process continues this way, to see much more of a defeat.
Well, John, what do you think Netanyahu meant when he said Israel is paying a heavy price for the Gaza war?
As you are aware, from the beginning of the genocide in Gaza, the Israeli officials, the Zionist officials, have been hiding the truth. Obviously, the casualty, the progress on the ground. They've been actually getting good beating, you know. Nobody can actually deny that. In fact, the last few articles last week in Haaretz obviously make it clear that the soldiers is using diapers, they've been scared, they, in the end, they're forced to remove the so-called the best unit in the army, Golani Brigade, because they lost nearly a quarter of their coward army, member of army. So there is a problem, because every time the resistance killed 10 people, they declare 4 and 3 injured. And then you have this Israeli media camping outside Soroka Hospital. They're counting how many bodies, you know. So they come out and say, oh, no, today 12. Netanyahu said 6. Today 15. Netanyahu said 4 and 6 injured. So the public now, to be honest with you, reading the Israeli media, the public repeating the same issue, which is repeated before, being said about the resistance in Lebanon, that Syed, they will believe Syed Nasrallah, then their own media, their own officials. They said Abu Baida is telling that truth, because every time Abu Baida said we killed 10 soldiers, 15 injured, it turned out to be true. So Netanyahu got no way now to be able to cover his lies. So he had to persuade by his advisor that the best way is to now to please the public, because he's under intense pressure from the public. He had set goals to obviously to achieve in Gaza. One of them is to release the hostages, and second, which is to defeat Hamas. Okay? Well, he'd been defeating hospitals and schools, civilians, nursing homes. He defeated no Hamas, released no hostages.
Right. Stay with me, because I want to talk a little bit later about these goals that they had and if they reached them or not. But Daniel, the Netanyahu had said that it was a difficult day on Saturday, but they will continue with full force until the end, and that it will be a long war until they reach their goals. Your analysis of what he says, what he means.
Obviously, the Zionist entity can only exist through perpetual warfare. So even if we look beyond the current circumstances of October 7, there obviously has to be perpetual violence for the Zionist entity to survive. And if we also look at the internal political dynamics within the entity, they have been very fragile with several elections in the past couple of years, the entire Netanyahu regime being in a crisis with court cases against them. So obviously a prolonged war to some extent might also serve as a distraction. That's when we talk about the internal political communication in the entity. But of course, the Israeli regime is very well aware that it cannot win this war. And it is, of course, aware that the rhetoric it is presenting to its Western backers about the allegedly about hostages, about Hamas, is, of course, only part of the broader story. And the Israeli regime has no strategy in Gaza other than indiscriminately bombing everyone and committing a genocide. And it is seeing how weak it is. So, of course, it will obviously continue to invest into prolonging this war. And it will, of course, continue to pose economic and political and, of course, social negative circumstances within the entity. I mean, according
to
some...
Well, let me just jump in here, Daniel. Well, why would they want to prolong it if you said that the entity knows that it cannot win and it's taking a toll on the economy and in every way? Why does it want to prolong it then?
Because a ceasefire at this point might be seen as a defeat by the Israeli regime, because it has to obviously is playing on the fear among its own settler population, constructing Palestinians as the common enemy, and also through that by projecting Palestinians as the external enemy, tying together some sort of solidarity among the settler population. And at the same time, of course, this is an existential crisis for the Israeli regime. This is a genocidal regime. Its ideology is genocidal. And of course, it has, according to recent polls, the full backing of the vast majority of the Israeli population. So there is no reason for the Israeli regime to actually stop at this point, because the other question would also be what would be the next steps.
Okay. Well, John, the regime has not accomplished any of its stated goals, as I was saying before, which were to wipe out the resistance, destroy the tunnels, and free the captives. Your thoughts on why the regime hasn't been able to reach any of these goals, and what does that say in general about the Israeli military?
Well, the image which has been giving about the Israeli military, that they are strongest military in the Middle East, which is, as you know, in 1967, defeated three Arab armies. That's what they claim. But now you're talking about the Palestinian resistance, who has actually been in a big military, a big concentration camp for the last 17 years. Most of these fighters, they are orphans. They lost their families, they lost their mothers, they lost their neighbors, you know. And the Palestinians, the indigenous, this is the land where Palestinians fighting. These people are your visitors. They're coming from Europe. They occupy the land, you know. And this is an American war. The state, actually a welfare state, lives on the American dollar, you know. It's not a normal state, to be honest with you. It's not a normal entity at all. So the Palestinians willing to, it's not about using top guns and about tanks. And you see that their Merkava being actually damaged daily, you know, day and night. It's about the belief on your cause, and you're willing to die for your cause. The Israeli soldiers, which is, again, I have to repeat, using divers, they claiming about bad dreams, dreaming of Hamas in their bedrooms, you know, they are a coward who has just been forced to go and to bomb people, kill children and women. So the Palestinian resistance will not give up their goal, because this is the Palestinian land, and the Palestinian youth who was actually brought to the resistance had to defend it to the end.
Well, Daniel, I mean, what is happening inside of Gaza with the regime on the ground now, the troops, and they're committing heinous crimes? I mean, it's a classic case of any crime just about that we can think about against humanity and genocide, where no place is really safe for the people, from depriving them of food and water to assassinating civilians in front of their families. What is this about? Why is it that they're trying to inflict so much pain on the Palestinian people? I mean, is this part of their goal?
Very good question. And I think if we look at the developments and the increase in intensity and the details of this brutal, cruel torture of Palestinians in the past two and a half months, it is really, I would say, unprecedented. And we also need to take into consideration that this is the most sophisticated, best-developed settler colonial project in a contemporary history with the most sophisticated weapons. And Palestinians are in this situation victims of not only the Israeli regime, but of the West to some extent that backs this genocide. So it appears that Israelis feel empowered to some extent because they know there is no accountability. There is no one intervening after 2.5 months to stop them from these crimes. And no matter what crimes they committed, the bombing of, as has been highlighted, of hospitals, churches, mosques, schools, bakeries, the many different ways in which civilians have been killed. And Israel has so far gotten away with all of these war crimes. And of course, none of these crimes have started on October 7th. So there's obviously the factor that there is no accountability, no one who is going to hold the Israeli regime accountable, that of course plays a role here. But it also really shows to what extent this may again be a very existential battle, because Palestinians have been dehumanized, not just in the settler colonial rhetoric, but in the Western political elites and media landscape for decades, to an extent where they're not necessarily seen as human beings, which is, I guess, one of the factors that plays a role in the lack of international outrage. And the other very dangerous development that I would identify is this compassion fatigue, which somehow may have emerged. Because if you look back at the ways in which the first sort of massacres after October 7 were reported on, and now there are massacres 24/7 on a daily basis, and it has become normalized to some extent. And the question really is what the threshold is and how far the Israelis are, they can even go at this point in their torture.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Yeah, it just seems that there is absolutely no red line, unfortunately, with this regime. Now, John, I want to look at the other side of the coin. Inside of the Israeli entity itself, we have reports of up to 7% now of settlers have left the regime, as more and more of the Israelis are looking at possibilities of leaving, and some of them not returning. Your thoughts on that?
Well, look, I mean, you got to keep in mind one thing, that this war, obviously, so far, from the 7th of October till the 3rd of November, cost him 50 billion shekels. Shekel is their obviously, their money. And obviously, the issue here, if you look at the situation within the entity, 200,000 people being displaced, which is previously before the 7th of October, lived on the border of Gaza, on the occupied Palestine in 1948, and 250,000 displaced from the other side where the Palestine border, Palestine-Lebanon border, which is make a big, big, obviously, pressure on the Zionist entity in terms of the economy. Now, the also, you don't forget, there is a 18% of the absent force, workforce, the people who do not go to work, the because of their draft. Most of these guys, 350,000, have been called to join the army. Schools and universities are closed. Getting homes for children, manufacturing, export and import down to 50%, you know. So if this, and tourism, don't forget that the airport closed, work a few hours a day. And don't forget one thing, that the main defeat will be after the Hamas defeat, is their economy will be shattered, and they will be forced to stop their crimes, and they would be forced to leave Gaza, and the Palestinians will obviously have to regain the land, which is especially the north area. The Israeli plan was to keep that north as a buffer zone, which is not going to happen. Today, I just been watching the news. One of the Palestinians in Beit Hanun, exactly at the border of 1967, said the army left. You know, so it cost them daily $269 million a day. Mm-hmm. You know, so how far the American going to keep printing for how long? You know, so it is going to be a defeat also on the other front, which is the paying daily to the businesses which have been closed as a compensation. They're paying 150,000 shekel, 150,000 million shekels, you know, to all these businesses. Okay. So they're going to be defeated really by themselves, you know, not only in terms of military, also an economy, which is very, very important.
Right. Well, Danielle, inside of the regime also, more and more people are turning against Netanyahu for not being successful in the war and not rescuing the captives. And let's talk about this side of things. It never seemed like he even cared about his own people. So in the eyes of many of these settlers inside of the regime, he has failed them. I mean, your thoughts, General?
Yeah, there have been protests against him also even before October 7 because of several scandals that he has apparently been involved in. But at the same time, we need to keep in mind that there is not much of a difference, or probably no difference at all, between the different political parties in the Zionist entity, because at the end, all of them support what is currently happening. So it is very much, there is no alternative when it comes to the question of ideology or the approach to Palestinians. So even here, it is very much a dynamic within the settler colony, where we see the anxieties of the settler population about what would be the most effective way to defeat the indigenous people, in this case, Palestinians. So, of course, I think that the internal dynamics and Netanyahu's declining popularity obviously play a role, and he can, in many ways, has been also in the past been using attacks on Palestinians for his own political gain. But at the end, I don't think it makes much of a difference to the outside who is in power as the prime, so-called prime minister or president of the Zionist entity, because again, it is a structural a realization of their structural ideology and policy, what we see unfolding in Gaza.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, I'm out of time, but I appreciate both of you being with me. Out of Barcelona, Danielle Yejit, chancellor and researcher. Out of London, John Phoenix, journalist and international relations expert. And thank you, as always. We appreciate you joining us for another Spotlight. Well, I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. We have Brother Suhail as the guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom to answer today's question. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Suhail. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum salam. Thank you for having me in the show.
Okay, Brother Suhail, the Muslim and the Shiite ones are waiting for the reappearance or the zuhur of Imam Asr, Imam Zaman. Whether it is considered a specific time for the reappearance of Imam Asr, first the question is this, that is there any specific time for the reappearance of Imam Asr or not? And are there any barriers on the way of reappearance of Imam Asr, and what are they?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So in regards to the reappearance of the Imam, we have seen a lot of narrations that say anyone who says or specifies the time of the Imam is qadhib, is a liar.
Mm-hmm.
You see, anyone who states anything,
yes,
apart from that his appearance, inshallah, is soon, nobody can come and specify when that appearance is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so in that sense, we know that we can not specify the time of the appearance.
The timing is not clear. That's
yeah,
right.
The timing is not clear.
Mm-hmm. So the timing is not clear, but the reappearance is for sure happening.
Yeah, the reappearance is for sure. For we have traditions that say that if there is no Imam in this world, the world would be chaotic and it wouldn't be a place for anyone to live in.
Mm-hmm.
Because it needs someone to balance the weight between good and evil in this concept of having an imam. And even we have traditions that say that there are going to be 12 companions or 12 imams after me from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him. We have another tradition is that even if the day of judgment is supposed to reach today or tomorrow, for example,
yes,
Allah will extend this day into a limited period where the Qaim would come, rule, govern, and make sure the Haq is separated from the batil.
Mm-hmm.
The right is separated from the wrong, and it's clear for everyone to follow the right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Are there any interfering factors that postpone the reappearance of Imam As? Or no, they are just made up stories in the minds of the people. For example, do not do this, do not do that, the reappearance of the Imam will be postponed. Is it so?
So normally there's a general view,
mm-hmm,
and the specifics are normally related to this general view. You see, we have a quotation from Sheikh Tusi,
mm-hmm,
that says the cause of the obstacle in the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is nothing but the fear of being killed. You see, because if there had been any other reason, his remaining in occultation would not have been justified. You see, but there are many reasons for him not appearing right now. One is that the people are not ready, and people do mistakes that are already there in history.
Mm-hmm.
You see, so we recite in one of the ziyarat, if I'm not mistaken, this is the verse, Nusrati lakum ma'adda.
Mm-hmm.
You see, where we say, oh, Imam, we are ready for you. You see? But the problem is that we say that, but when the Imam comes, what is going to happen? Like, let's say, Imam is here right now when I go outside, and Imam comes and he says, Aghaya Suhail, you say that you are ready to give me your support.
Mm-hmm.
You see? Now I'm here. What support can you give me?
Yes.
You see, a lot of issues is that people do not ponder on when they recite this kind of quotations or verses or ahadith, that what does being ready mean?
Mm-hmm.
You see, we know that the Imam is going to come. We know that there's going to be a war. We know that he's going to have an army of approximately 313 people like the companions of Badr.
Yes.
We know all of that. But in an army, we need fighting men. Are we exercising ourselves for the sake of Imam? You see, he needs people that are strong. Are we exercising to be able to be strong? He needs political people in his group to be able to analyze policies for his army.
Mm-hmm.
We need people who are smart. We need people who are learned. A lot of questions that are attached, maybe they are not from Ahadith, but they are logical concepts that we see that Imam requires these people in his ministry.
Yes.
And if he's not able to find these people, then his team wouldn't work as it's supposed to work. So people need to work on that aim and agenda. So for example, right now, you'll see a lot of people that are marrying in marriage. We see that people do not want kids. They say that they want to have fun, they want to enjoy, and maybe afterwards. Now, this afterwards is a question because when you want, you are thinking about a child, it's not like kun fayakun. That is for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yes.
It's not up to a human being. And now, when